From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, reaction and fallout after the firing of FBI Director James Comey.
If Hillary Clinton had won the election, which thank God she didn't, but if she had and she had been in the same position, she would have fired Comey immediately, and the very Democrats that are criticizing the president today would be dancing in the streets celebrating.
Also today, novelist Hala Alyan on a story of generations of war and displacement in one Palestinian family.
I definitely think that there's an intergenerational trauma that went along with losing a homeland that you see trickle down through the different generations.
And do the troubles at UMass Boston run deeper than its recent leadership?
It's embarrassing how we fund our public higher education here in Massachusetts. The administration has made mistakes, but we can't reduce it to one person. So we need to hold all those people accountable.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and let's get right to the latest on reaction and consequences to President Donald Trump's abrupt firing of FBI Director James Comey. The president had a previously scheduled meeting with the Russian foreign minister today, and when the White House press pool was allowed into the Oval Office after the meeting, everyone had the same question.
Why did you fire Director Comey? Why did you fire Director Comey?
Because he wasn't doing a good job, very simply. He was not doing a good job.
Did it affect your meeting with the Russians today?
Excuse me?
Did it affect your meeting with the Russians today?
And in just the past hour, White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer was not at the daily White House press briefing. Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders filled in.
Most of America had decided on their own that Director Comey was not the person that should be leading the FBI, as evidenced by the numerous comments that we've seen from Democrat members in the House and Senate, Republican members, members of the FBI, and people across the board.
So a lot going on in Washington. Let's hear from Matt Visor. He's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Matt, it's good to have you back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's just start off with where Sarah Huckabee Sanders, again, the deputy White House press secretary, left us here. She ran the daily press briefing today. Did we get any further clarity from the White House on why the president decided to fire Comey so abruptly yesterday?
Well, at least their case a little bit. I mean, they've elaborated a little bit on their timeline, which is Monday that there was this meeting at the White House with the Deputy Attorney General and the Attorney General, them both recommending Comey's firing. They put that recommendation into writing on Tuesday, and that's when, again, according to the White House, that's when Trump decided to fire the FBI director.
Right. Now, of course, in his letter informing Comey that he had been fired, the president wrote, "While I greatly appreciate you informing me on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation, I nevertheless concur with the judgment of the Department of Justice that you are not able to effectively lead the Bureau." Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders was asked a couple of times, why did the president write about these three separate occasions and what are they? And how did she answer?
She declined to answer or elaborate in any which way on that claim, which is a pretty bold claim that the FBI director would be telling the president of the United States that he is not under investigation on three different occasions. This is, according to the president, sort of exonerating himself in this letter. And we don't have much detail on what those three instances were, what the language was from the FBI director, if he's not being investigated at this time. There's various ways in which that could have been said. But we don't know. We don't know a lot of those answers because the White House has so far declined to elaborate on that letter.
Now, Matt, let's move over to how the Democrats are responding. What have some key Democrats been saying?
Well, there was sort of an extraordinary moment this morning with Chuck Schumer, the Senate, the top Democrat in the Senate, giving a speech on the Senate floor all of the Senate Democrats there with him. He is calling on the Republican majority leader to convene the entire Senate for a briefing, potentially a classified briefing, with the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General to talk more about the firing of James Comey. Senate Democrats are also today not participating in Senate committee hearings, which is sort of grinding work in the Senate to a halt. They can't progress on other sort of routine aspects that go on Capitol Hill because Democrats are protesting the lack of information and the lack of response around James Comey. They're also increasingly calling on a special counsel, a special prosecutor to get involved, to be appointed to investigate the things that James Comey had been investigating, which is the Russian meddling in the U.S. elections and Trump ties to that.
Now, Matt, as you know, the White House is, of course, standing firmly by the president's decision to fire Comey. They've been saying that it's, you know, part of the quick and decisive action that Donald Trump is known for. But on the other hand, it feels like the White House also, or the administration, very strongly misread the reaction that they'd get from doing this. I mean, does that surprise you by, you know, how vehement the reaction has been and how the White House seemed to have been caught off guard?
It doesn't strike me that the vehemence of the reaction. It does strike me as odd that the White House would underestimate that. Russia and the Russian ties, you know, have been sort of an ongoing theme for this presidency, and you know, this president having to deal with from even before he entered the White House. So it was not without any irony that today he met in the Oval Office with Sergey Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, by all accounts a meeting that was scheduled before we knew any of this stuff about James Comey being fired, but it certainly came on an interesting day. But they did seem to misjudge the reaction to Comey's firing, in large part because you have the chief person who's investigating these incidents, these Russian ties, being fired by the guy who has the most to lose by some of that investigation.
Yeah. And Matt, finally, what are you going to be keeping your eyes on in terms of things that may happen in the next couple of days?
I think that there's the, you know, who the White House turns to appoint as the next FBI director is certainly an interesting question. But there's also, you know, we're learning a lot right now where the White House has continued to claim that there's no evidence of collusion. And to be clear, there is not. But all indications are that this investigation was starting to gain some traction that Comey was overseeing. Subpoenas have recently gone out relating to Michael Flynn, the top campaign advisor and former national security advisor. And Comey just days ago reportedly asked for additional resources for this investigation. So I think we're going to learn a lot more about what Comey was doing in the days and weeks leading up to his firing, and that may shed a little bit more light on the motivations behind President Trump in firing him.
Matt Visor, he's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, speaking to us from Washington. Matt, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, as Matt said, key members of both parties have been speaking out all day today from the floor of the Senate for the Democrats. Here's California Democrat Dianne Feinstein.
The decision to fire Comey raises questions about the appropriateness and timing of firing the person in charge of an investigation that could, I won't say would, but could implicate the administration.
Well, Senate Majority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell had some pretty strong words in reaction to that. He said Democrats are being hypocritical in their concern for Comey now.
Here's what we have now, Mr. President. Our Democratic colleagues complaining about the removal of an FBI director whom they themselves repeatedly and sharply criticized.
Well, let's hear now from a member of the Massachusetts congressional delegation. Just a few moments ago, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks spoke with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren.
The decision to fire Comey, allegedly because of the way Comey handled the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, Democrats like you certainly had issues with the way Comey handled that, especially when he announced he was reopening the investigation just 10 days before last November's election. So is there any part of this that's strange for Democrats to be now so upset that he's been dismissed?
The idea that Donald Trump now claims, after having embraced Comey during the campaign and embraced Comey once he was elected president and embraced Comey to be his FBI director. But now that Comey's getting close in an investigation, wants to fire him and then lay it off on the connection to Hillary Clinton, the reasoning is laughable. The truth is obvious. Donald Trump does not want anyone near him with an investigatory powers about his connection to his campaign and ties to Russia.
Well, in your view, what does Comey's firing mean to the ongoing investigation? In other words, does the investigation continue at the FBI? And if it does, do you have any confidence in its ability to seek out the facts?
Well, look, I think it means that we must have a special prosecutor here. And we've got to have someone who is independent, who has got the resources, who has got the authority to get to the bottom of this. Good, bad, or indifferent, whatever is the truth here, we need a special prosecutor to get the truth out there. And everyone should care about that, Democrats, Republicans, independents. Donald Trump is trying to set himself up as above the law. That's not how it works in America.
Well, let me ask you about calls for a special prosecutor. I know the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has resisted that. He resisted it again today. And up until today, very few Republicans in Washington have agreed with Democrats like you that an independent prosecutor is necessary. Has that changed at all today? In other words, are you hearing something different from your Republican Senate colleagues?
Yes. Donald Trump has stepped over a line. And I think it's causing a lot of people who were confident that the FBI will get to the bottom of this on their own to rethink that assumption. By the way, I should point out, no president in history has fired a director of the FBI for an investigation. One has been fired before for ethics violations. You know, the only person who tried that general move was Richard Nixon, who tried to fire members of the Justice Department who were getting too close in their investigation of him. But Trump has made it clear he doesn't want this investigation to go forward, and that means it is now the responsibility of Congress to demand a special prosecutor. It's got to be someone who is truly independent. It's got to be someone who truly has the resources to be able to get to the bottom of this and truly has the authority to be able to investigate wherever that investigation leads. I mean, let's be clear here. Comey wanted more resources to be able to pursue the investigation, and he asked for those resources last week. And yet, what happens? Instead of getting the resources he needs from the Deputy Attorney General, instead of getting those resources, he gets fired.
Hmm. Senator, you mentioned, and you're not the only one, sort of obvious parallels here to the Watergate investigation. And
yep,
we know where that led, serious constitutional crisis that ended up with a president resigning. Do you see, I mean, to what extent are these, are there parallels here? And how is this different, or is it different?
Well, the obvious place where there are parallels is that there's an investigation into whether or not there was criminal activity on the part of an election campaign and on the part of the president himself, and then an effort, first by Nixon and now by Trump, to cut off the investigation by firing people. What makes this time around different is there's an extra layer in here, and that is of national security. We know from our intelligence community that the Russians hacked into American systems in order to influence the outcome of the election. And it's not just here in the United States. It's been in Europe. And so, you know, the Russians have developed a new weapon. And it's not a weapon that leaves a nuclear signature. It's a weapon that interferes right at the heart of democracy, directly into the electoral system. And every American, Democrat, Republican, independent, should want to get to the bottom of this and find out exactly how Russia interfered in our elections and what kind of ties Russia has to the sitting president of the United States.
That's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. She spoke with WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks just a little bit earlier. Now, to how all of this is washing back over at the Department of Justice. Trump's firing of Comey, he fired Comey after receiving memos from both Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who had recused himself from any Russia investigations, and from Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, whose memo provided more detailed reasoning for the firing. Well, today, Senate Minority Leader Democrat Chuck Schumer questioned their involvement.
Why was Attorney General Sessions, who had recused himself from the Russia investigations, able to influence the firing of the man conducting the Russia investigation? Did Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein act on his own or at the direction of his superiors?
Well, Vice President Mike Pence defended Rosenstein.
Well, the Deputy Attorney General was confirmed just a few short weeks ago by the United States Senate. When he brought the recommendation to the president that the director of the FBI should be removed, President Trump provided the kind of strong and decisive leadership the American people have come to be accustomed from him.
Well, Donald Stern, he is former U.S. attorney for the District of Massachusetts. He served in that position from 1993 to 2001. He's currently managing director of corporate monitoring and consulting services at Affiliated Monitors Incorporated. And Donald Stern joins us now. It's good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Megan.
First of all, can I just get your quick reaction to President Trump dismissing Director Comey?
Well, I was among those who were critical of Director Comey's press conference in July, and then his similar statements just in the lead-up to the election in November. But having said that, I never thought then or now that it was a firing offense. So I was, like I think most of America, I was stunned on the merits that the president would fire Director Comey, and stunned, frankly, with the timing, because it raises all kinds of questions and suspicions as to the motivations behind the firing. And finally, the way in which it was done is, I'm sure, very dispiriting and disheartening to the average agent in the field. I mean, the fact that no one spoke to the director before he was fired and that he learned about it while delivering a speech to agents in the L.A. office,
right,
and that's how he found out about it, is kind of shocking to me on its own terms, and disheartening and disrespectful, I think, to the Bureau.
Well, so react to what you heard in those two pieces of tape I played just before we brought you into the conversation from, you know, Chuck Schumer saying, questioning why Attorney General Jeff Sessions was involved in this decision, and also questioning Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. I mean, do you share those concerns?
Well, I think they're two separate issues. Firstly, with respect to the Attorney General Sessions, I agree with Senator Schumer. If you're recused from making, if you will, smaller decisions about an investigation, you ought not to be making the 800-pound gorilla decision, which is whether the person leading the investigation should stay or leave. So I'm surprised and I'm scratching my head as to why the Attorney General participated in that decision. The Deputy Attorney General's memo, which I've read because it's a public document at this point, made some good points, but I think the timing of the recommendation and ultimately the timing of the decision, again, raises a host of questions. I would be surprised if the Deputy Attorney General went into his office on his own, decided to write a memo, and then present it to the president, and the president said, oh, interesting memo. I think there's a lot of merit here. I'm going to fire the director. I can't imagine that's how it happened.
Right. Well, in today's White House press briefing, the Deputy White House Press Secretary said that apparently the Justice Department had met with the president on Monday, and that then President Trump heard their concerns. This is, again, from the White House press briefing today, and asked them to write a memo, which is what happened, which is why all of these documents are dated May 9th. They're all dated just yesterday. So that's, according to the White House, sort of the order in which things happened. But let me ask you in a little bit more detail about what Rosenstein wrote, because, you know, he wrote a couple of things that where he talked about how the Department of Justice believes that James Comey basically did an end run around the DOJ. The White House Deputy Press Secretary today called it throwing a stick of dynamite into the Department of Justice. Things like, you know, again, this is from the memo, quote, the director was wrong to usurp the attorney general's authority on July 5th, 2016 and announce his conclusion that the case regarding Hillary Clinton's emails should be closed without prosecution. It is not the function of the director to make such an announcement. I mean, these are legitimate concerns, right?
Those are some legitimate concerns, but it seems to me it rings very hollow to be made, first of all, 10 months after the fact, number one. Number two, secondly, when the now president on many occasions applauded and commended Director Comey for his courage and his integrity in making these decisions. And you can't untie this from the fact that there is an active ongoing investigation involving the Trump campaign's connection to Russia. I mean, I found it very odd that in the letter which the president sent, which is a short letter, I think it was under 100 words, in the heart of that letter, he said, and I want to thank you for telling me on three different occasions that I'm not under investigation. You know, it's the dot protest too much. I mean, if this has nothing to do with Russia, why do you introduce the whole Russian investigation into the letter firing the director? It just doesn't ring true. And by the way, I think there are a lot of questions to be asked about what did the director actually say to the president about the investigation. My guess is, first of all, he didn't say it in quite those terms that the president has repeated. And secondly, if I were the president or somebody who was told I was not under investigation, but yet there was an active investigation with all the people around me, I'm not sure I would take much comfort in that.
Right. As you know, several Democrats, you know, including Senator Elizabeth Warren, who we just heard from a couple of minutes ago, are calling for the appointment of a special prosecutor. Do you think it's time for that?
I do. If we had this conversation yesterday, I would have said no, because I'm not a big fan of the independent special prosecutors. I think the integrity of the Department of Justice and the FBI is enough to get us over the goal line with an independent investigation with integrity. But in light of what happened yesterday, I think this is really one of the exceptions to that. And I think it calls out for the appointment of an independent prosecutor. I don't see how else the public, Congress, the American people are going to have confidence in the outcome of an investigation.
Senator Mitch McConnell, though, today said that he disagrees with that, in part because of the ongoing investigation from the Senate Intelligence Committee. And he says that, you know, the appointment of a special prosecutor might impede or interfere with that investigation. Does that argument have merit?
No, that doesn't make any sense to me, because the independent prosecutor essentially becomes like the Department of Justice in terms of the ability to seek grand jury subpoenas, to investigate, to use FBI resources. So it is, in a sense, becomes a mini Department of Justice for purposes of that particular investigation, which is frankly why, under ordinary circumstances, I'm not a big fan of it. But what it does here is it guarantees that investigation is going to have sufficient resources, is going to have sufficient independence, and sufficient credibility to satisfy the American people that this has been done properly.
Yeah. Donald Stern, one last question for you. It is somewhat strange, or maybe given the times we live in, perhaps not so strange, but it's Attorney General Jeff Sessions who is going to be in charge of appointing an interim FBI director. He has recused himself, as we talked about earlier, from any Russia investigation, but he's going to be picking someone to be in charge of the FBI's Russia investigation.
It's odd. I don't know what else to say. It's certainly odd. I, by the way, have faith that the career agents in the FBI and the career prosecutors will do their best to conduct a fair and aggressive investigation. The problem is, not so much in the short run, but over the long haul, when the message being sent from the White House and maybe from higher-ups in the Department of Justice is, go slow, as the president has tweeted, this is a fake investigation, this is a waste of taxpayer money. Over time, that's going to sap the energy and the aggressiveness of any investigation if allowed to persist.
Donald Stern, he was former U.S. attorney, or is former U.S. attorney for the District of Massachusetts. He served that post from 1993 to 2001. Donald Stern, it's always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Okay, yeah, thank you. You're welcome.
Well, just moments ago, we got more reaction from the Massachusetts delegation. Congressman Seth Moulton spoke to reporters about the firing of James Comey, and he said this.
I think it is a national crisis, and I think it's quickly becoming a constitutional crisis because of the abuses of power that Trump and the executive branch are taking to cover up these crimes. But I don't think that anybody's fooled. You know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And there is so much smoke here, it seems like a massive bonfire.
That's Congressman Seth Moulton saying that he believes what we're witnessing is a national crisis. Well, let's get one more perspective, some context with a long view. Tim Weiner is a longtime investigative journalist. He worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where he won a Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of a secret Pentagon budget that was used to sponsor defense research. He's also former national security correspondent for the New York Times. He's written several books on the FBI and the CIA, including Enemies, A History of the FBI, and Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. That book won the National Book Award. His most recent book is One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon. Tim Weiner, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Okay, so put this event in context for us. How unusual is it for an FBI director to be fired before the end of his term?
No FBI director who is in the middle of an investigation involving the White House has ever been fired. Full stop.
Ever.
One FBI director has been fired with cause. His name was William Sessions, no relation to Jeff Sessions. He was the subject of a report at the end of the Bush 41 administration accusing him of petty corruption. He remained in office regardless, and then eventually, about 6 months into the Clinton administration, Attorney General Janet Reno determined that it was time for him to go.
Mm. Well, you heard that tape that we played from Congressman Seth Moulton a little bit ago, just a moment ago. He believes this is becoming a constitutional crisis. What's your take?
The subject of this FBI investigation is an attack on the United States and its democratic system and its electoral processes by a hostile enemy, Russia. The inquiry was proceeding to ask whether Americans aided and abetted this attack on the United States. It is the most politically charged counterintelligence investigation the FBI has run since the Soviets stilled the secrets of the atomic bomb. For the president to dismiss the FBI director in the middle of this investigation may someday be construed as an obstruction of justice.
It's that significant.
Yes, it is. If this investigation proceeds to the point where the FBI reaches the conclusion that people like the now-dismissed National Security Advisor, Michael Flynn, if other members of Team Trump colluded with Russian agents in a conspiracy to defeat Hillary Clinton and elect Donald Trump, that's as serious as it gets. John McCain has already called what the Russians did an act of war. And it is time for Republicans like Senator McCain and like Senator Richard Burr, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, to stiffen their spines and put together a bicameral investigative commission in Congress, like the one that investigated the Iran-Contra scandal 30 years ago, pool their resources and start digging, because the pursuit of a special prosecutor or an independent counsel out of this Justice Department with its recused attorney general is hopelessly compromised.
Tim Weiner, does it even need to get that far before, as you said, perhaps people like John McCain or a special prosecutor could potentially come to the conclusion that, you know, regardless of what a Russia investigation bears out, that the firing of James Comey yesterday constituted sufficient interference with that investigation?
That goes to the intent of the president. If you believe that Jim Comey was fired over his handling of Hillary Clinton's emails, I suggest you re-examine that presumption. I don't think anybody believes that. I think that this was an intemperate and hasty decision by a president who apparently enjoys firing people. That is how he became a reality television star, after all, and how he came to great public attention. To fire the FBI director in a way that, to put it politely, was disrespectful, and to do it when everyone in the United States knows that the FBI director is investigating an enormous counter-espionage case that clearly involves at least a handful of Trump associates, is breathtaking.
Hmm. For all the reasons that you just stated, this is a singular event. But in addition to that, though, haven't relationships between the FBI director or the FBI as a whole and various presidents been, you know, contentious for quite some time? Yeah.
The FBI investigated President Nixon and helped bring him down. The FBI investigated Ronald Reagan's national security team in the Iran-Contra affair and won quite a number of indictments. The FBI investigated Bill Clinton for years and wound up with the White House physician in attendance drawing blood from the president to match it with the DNA on the infamous blue dress. So yes, FBI directors and FBI agents have investigated presidents going back to Richard Nixon.
I want to ask you another question about how this might, or what impact this might have on the FBI itself. And in order to do that, I would like to just play you, Tim Weiner, a little bit of tape here from today's White House press briefing, where Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders took this question from a reporter.
There's a special agent who's inside who wrote us, who said, "The vast majority of the Bureau is in favor of Director Comey. This is a total shock. This is not supposed to happen. The real losers here are 20,000 frontline people in the organization because they lost the only guy working here in the past 15 years who actually cared about them." So what's your response to these rank-and-file FBI agents who disagree with your contention that they lost faith in Director Comey?
Look, we've heard from countless members of the FBI that say very different things. In fact, the president will be meeting with Acting Director McCabe later today to discuss that very thing, the morale at the FBI, as well as make an offer to go directly to the FBI if he feels that that's necessary and appropriate.
That's Deputy Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders responding to a question about why she claimed today that the rank and file inside the FBI had lost confidence in James Comey. I mean, Tim Weiner, what impact do you think this is going to have on the rank and file?
I think the way the president handled the dismissal of Jim Comey was disgraceful. I think that the majority of rank and file agents would agree with that. I think that it was a slap at the institution of the FBI to dismiss the director in this way. And I think that the vast majority of FBI agents believe in the rule of law. That's what they're there to defend. The principle that we are a government of laws, and not a government of men. And that they will continue this investigation unless it is obstructed by the White House or the Department of Justice.
Yeah. Tim Weiner, my last question for you. I've seen you quoted a little bit earlier today as saying that what happened yesterday and the repercussions of firing Comey, it's like Whitewater, I'm sorry, like Watergate, but in fast forward. What's your response to people who say that that's just a plain old overreaction?
Well, it took Richard Nixon into the fifth year of his presidency before he had to dismiss close aides who were enmeshed in criminal investigations and then eventually fire the special prosecutor who was investigating the White House. We are now, I believe, 110 days into the Trump administration, and he has fired the acting attorney general, Sally Yates, his national security advisor, Mike Flynn, and the FBI director, Jim Comey, all of whom played different but key roles in the Russia case. I lived through Watergate. I'm sure many of your listeners did, and it does seem like seeing the movie in fast forward at warp speed. Now, whether it will have a similar conclusion, I do not know. Richard Nixon faced a Democratic Congress and a Supreme Court that voted 8-0 that he had to turn over his secret tapes. We're in a different political environment today.
Well, Tim Weiner is a Pulitzer Prize-winning and National Book Award-winning journalist. His books include Enemies, A History of the FBI, also Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA, and One Man Against the World, The Tragedy of Richard Nixon. Tim Weiner, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Hala Alyan was 4 years old when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Her family packed up what they could and left their home. And in the years that followed, her family moved over a dozen times between the Middle East and the United States. And as she grew up, she tried to process the chaos of constantly moving. So Alyan started to write. She's an award-winning poet and clinical psychologist, and now she's published her first novel. It's called Salt Houses, and it follows a Palestinian family grappling with the ramifications of being displaced by war. And Hala Alyan joins us in the studio now. She'll be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight talking about her book. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, before we get into the specifics of your beautiful book, I'd just love to hear more about you and mm-hmm. and your journey. Tell us about how leaving Kuwait.
Yeah, I mean, I was four, so some of my earliest memories are from that time, but most of it obviously has been filtered through my parents. I think the most salient memory is I had just turned four, and my mother had wanted me not to open all my birthday presents at once. So we left a bunch of like unopened birthday gifts. And that was something that my mother would like cry about year after year, remembering that time. It was a time when like banks shut down. My mom escaped with me and she was pregnant with my brother and drove through Iraq, went to Syria. When my father was able to catch up with us, he went to Syria as well.
Oh, it's interesting.
We were there for a little bit. And then,
Syria doesn't seem like a place of refuge today.
Which is what's
so
fascinating to think about. I mean, in that region and in general, the idea of immigration and displacement, it's like places that were refuge are not anymore. That many places that are shelters have become places where people flee.
So in all the times and places that you had to move mm-hmm. In the intervening years, I mean, what effect did that have on you and your family and how it sort of defined itself and saw itself?
Yeah, I think it sort of manifested differently in all of us. I mean, I think for myself and my brother and my sister, it sort of manifested in wanting to tell stories and becoming writers and artists and becoming very kind of obsessed with this idea of memory and nostalgia and how to recreate memory and preserve it. It's been interesting to see how it manifests differently between my mother and father. My father's very restless and has a hard time settling in any one city. Whereas my mother loves to think about homes and just nesting and loves Architectural Digest. And so I think it's kind of manifested very differently in our family. But there is a shared understanding that, you know, you can't take any city for granted.
Yeah.
You don't know what will happen.
Yeah. Well, in your novel, Salt Houses, you follow a Palestinian family over time. But one of the key people at the center of the book is Salma. Right? Yeah, she's the matriarch, of this family. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about her and why you wanted to put her at the center of the novel.
Well, so she, I think, so the character that ends up kind of popping up is her daughter, Alia.
Yeah.
But the very heart of it would be Selma, be this original character who was raising her children in that kind of interesting, very politically tense period of time between 1948 and 1967 in what is now the West Bank. And she's sort of trying to manage her desires for her children with political realities, trying to keep them safe, but also connected to their homeland. And it really all begins with her. Mm-hmm. And then when the Six-Day War happens, they lose their house and they find themselves in Kuwait, only to be displaced again after a couple of decades.
Yeah. So it's so interesting about hearing this particular story, this kind of story about a Palestinian mm-hmm. family, because it's not one that we often mm-hmm. get a chance to hear about or explore. I mean, was that part of the impetus for you for writing mm-hmm. the novel?
I wouldn't say that I set out with a particular agenda. I know that as I was writing, I was falling in love with the family and I was becoming very invested and I wanted to do justice to this particular family. And I think in trying to do that, it became kind of a bigger glimpse into the situation in general and into the idea of displacement and diasporic experience and memory in general. I think the book definitely doesn't purport to be representative of the entire Palestinian experience. This is a very specific family with socioeconomic background, with certain privileges, with certain opportunities. And I do think it's, from what I've heard from people, I think that can sometimes make it a little bit easier to connect to for many readers who have a certain amount of luxury and privilege to be able to see themselves in these characters that were able to have the financial privilege of leaving, mm-hmm. and being able to get passports and being able to move to different cities.
Right, right. So you mentioned a little bit earlier how Alia, Salma's daughter, mm-hmm. is different from her mother. I mean, tell us a little bit about how you explore those differences.
Well, I think, it's sort of the classical, intergenerational conflict, right? So, I think that's one of the things that the book kind of looks at is how it's really hard to raise children in a country that is not your own, where there's a value system, where there's a belief system, where there's a way of doing things that's very different to how you grew up. So I do think there's a lot of rebelling within some of the parental-child relationships in the book. I've always been interested in that idea of intergenerational trauma and how it manifests differently from generation to generation. But also, I think a lot of the times that's one of the ways in which these familial relationships end up getting really complicated.
Yeah.
You grow up, someone who's born and raised in Boston, for example, is going to have a very different connection and idea of family and home than someone who immigrated here when they're 45.
Hmm. Your book comes along at a time where, of course, our national conversation about refugees who make up a significant part of any group's diaspora around the world. It's very complicated and it's very fraught.
Yeah.
Obviously, not just here in the United States, but in many places. I'm just wondering, how you're thinking through that mm-hmm. in terms of your own personal experience as well.
Yeah. Well, I think, there's my experience. There's the experience that I've seen with a lot of the patients that I work with in clinical work. Yeah. I like to think of it as a lack of imagination on some level, that I think for a lot of people, it's very difficult to really understand what it must be like when you have to flee a country. And there's that whole quote of you only put your kid on a raft and put them out to sea if it's safer than the land, that people are not doing this because they're trying to sneak their way into countries. People are not fleeing by the millions just to try to inundate these Western countries. They're doing it because they have no other choice. Most people don't want to leave their home country. Mm-hmm. They'd rather stay. And I do think that there's a certain, hopefully, being able to force ourselves to be a little bit uncomfortable and have conversations that are difficult, it might help us challenge some of these ideas that we have.
Yeah. Well, Hala Alyan, she is a Palestinian-American writer and a clinical psychologist, as you mentioned. Her debut novel is Salt Houses. She'll be talking about it at the Harvard Bookstore tonight. We'll have more information about that at radioboston.org. Thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for the book.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Back in April, UMass Boston Chancellor Keith Motley announced that he would be stepping down at the end of this academic year, and that announcement came as the institution searches for answers to fill its $30 million budget deficit. Now, there have been a lot of debate and discussion as to how UMass Boston got to this place, but one staff member says it's time to look much further back into the university's history. Tom Goodkind is a senior research machinist. He's been at UMass Boston for 31 years. He's also president of the UMass Boston Professional Staff Union, and he joins us now. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
So you wrote quite a compelling op-ed recently where you said we've got to look back at the founding days of UMass Boston and, you know, sort of the challenges that it faced in the earliest years of the institution. Why is that?
Well, yeah, that was a speech I delivered to the Board of Trustees.
Yeah, yeah.
And I felt that at the time that the focus was too much on individual mismanagement. I think in general there's a feeling that, you know, if something good happens, it's because some individual did something, and if something bad happens, it's because some individual did something. And I think things are much more complicated than that. I think in UMass Boston, it's like anything else. If you want to understand a thing, you have to understand the history of the thing.
Yeah.
And at UMass Boston, everything that we're facing today, I think, goes back to basically three strands of history in our campus. I mean, first there's, I would break it down to the situation in Boston with busing and mm-hmm. racism in which we were founded and in which the campus rose up out of the landfill. There's the corruption in the original construction of the campus,
right,
which we're still dealing with. And there's been the 25-year period of public disinvestment, which is something that's happened throughout the country but has been very bad in Massachusetts.
So can I just pick at that second strand here,
sure,
just for a second? Because for folks who don't remember, there was the Ward Commission, right, which
that's
was
right,
looking at how billions of dollars were spent on construction of public institutions around Massachusetts, and a lot of that was found to not have, actually been used to the best of its ability, right?
Yes, and there was extortion of a construction firm, MBM, and some Massachusetts state senators went to jail for this and so on. And the effects of this were actually, I mean, let me put it this way. I got there in 1986, which was 1985, only 11 years after the campus was built, and already roofs were leaking, the foundations were rotting. Bricks were flying off our tallest building and so on. And it's only gotten worse.
So you're reminding us that if there is mismanagement at UMass Boston, it's not recent.
And that wasn't mismanagement at UMass Boston.
That was across,
in particular.
Yeah.
That was corruption in the way state contracts were awarded at the time. And you can read the Ward Commission report from 78, I think it was, which details all that.
Yeah. You know, you also mentioned something else, which I think is quite important, that you chafe at what you call the push for UMass Boston to engage in workforce development for its student. And you say that it's for its students. And you say that, you know, no one tells Harvard that they got to do a better job at workforce development.
Yeah. I think, I mean, that partially comes from a speech that Secretary of Education Pizer made on the campus back in September at our convocation. And basically, he was telling us to trim our sails. He was asking us to face reality. It was a reality that he and others have helped create. And he was telling us that, you know, it was a time of scarcity. It's not actually a time of scarcity. It's a time of inequality. And he was basically saying that a place like UMass Boston needs to do what it does best. And we were supposed to focus on things that would be more aligned with the workforce needs. The fact is, we're the only public research university in Boston. Nobody else has a student body like ours, and I could give statistics on that. Nobody else gives these students, basically working class students from urban communities throughout Massachusetts, working class students of color, white working class students, the opportunity to go to a four-year university and explore every aspect of what a university education is. We're not just channeling them into this or that job.
Right. So we've just got under a minute here to go. I appreciate the reminders of sort of UMass Boston's past and also sort of what its core mission is in terms of the student body that it represents and educates. But with those things in mind now, Tom Goodkind, I mean, again, in the couple seconds we have, how does this help us understand how the university needs to move forward from this point?
I don't think we can move forward unless we understand that the crisis we're in now, which is mainly related to the need to rebuild the campus, that the state and the Board of Trustees have to take a big share of responsibility for that. We can't just leave it to the students who currently bear the burden of all the construction that we have to do.
In terms of paying for it.
Yeah, paying for it. That's who's paying for it now.
Well, Tom Goodkind is a senior research machinist. He's been working at UMass Boston for more than 30 years. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks a lot, Meghna.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.